From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Oscar Lopez Rivera has been called the Nelson Mandela of Puerto Rico. Indeed, like the South African legend, Rivera was imprisoned for his anti-colonial activism and spent decades in prison. But in January 2017, after serving 35 years of a 70-year sentence, President Barack Obama, as one of his last acts in office, commuted Rivera's sentence. In May 2017, Oscar Lopez Rivera was a free man. He had been a member of the underground militant organization FALN, which targeted military bases and other symbols of American imperialism. Rivera, however, denied involvement in any actions that hurt people. Over time, he became a symbol of resistance to people the world over and became one of the longest-serving political prisoners in the world. Among those who spoke out for his release were Archbishop Desmond Tutu, Pope Francis, Senator Bernie Sanders, playwright Lin-Manuel Miranda, and others. On February 7th, 2018, Rivera spoke at Pasadena City College as part of a nationwide speaking tour, and I had the chance to interview him on stage after his speech. Here is an excerpt of that conversation. President Obama chose to commute your sentence, and I'm wondering how you reacted when that happened, how you view his action, how you even view his presidency through the lens of the fact that he basically signed your freedom.
I was not prepared at all to receive the news that my sentence had been commuted. When my lawyer told me that President Barack Obama had commuted my sentence, but that I had to remain under house arrest or not completely. Being free on the 17th of January, I wasn't prepared for the news. So she asked me, how did I feel? And I told her the truth. I told her I felt the same way I felt 3-4 days ago, a year ago, 5 years ago, because I was prepared. I was prepared for the day that I will be told, this is it, you never coming out of prison. So I was most prepared for that. But then about 3 days later, I was going through all my documents because I was starting to pack, and all of a sudden it dawned on me that there was a possibility that I would be going home. And from that moment on, I started feeling really, really good about that possibility. And then on the 9th of February, I stepped out of Terre Haute Penitentiary, and I arrived in Puerto Rico, where I still had to do quite a few months in home confinement. So it was not until the 17th of May that I was able to walk on the street of Puerto Rico as a free Puerto Rican. But I want to point this out. The President of the United States, I'm very grateful to President Barack Obama for making the decision, but the force behind the decision were the people who love freedom and justice in this world. For example, Bishop Desmond Tutu, for example, Pope Francis, the many, many, many leaders of the world. They're letters from beautiful, beautiful people who have dedicated their lives for peace, for freedom, for justice, to make this a better and more just world. So, yeah, those are the people that made it possible. Puerto Ricans, the overwhelming majority of Puerto Ricans, were able to transcend their political differences, their class differences, their religious difference, their sexual preferences and identities, everything that had stopped us in the past from coming together came together around the campaign to excarcerate me.
So there are, of course, still many political prisoners that remain imprisoned today. Can you give us some names of people? Because once You are behind bars. The world forgets about you. So as somebody who spent 3.5 decades behind bars, who should we think about today that are continuing to be political prisoners that you want to see free? And what lessons can activists take from the movement to free you, which was successful?
I was in prison with Leonard Peltier for 2.5 years, from 1984 through 1986. I was in prison with Sundiata Kolo, who was a Sekou Odinga. I was in prison with Tom Manning, with Ray LaVasseur. I was in prison with Yukimura. I was in prison with many of the prisoners who remain in prison, especially Leonard. But then we have several prisoners who are political prisoners. Herman Bell, Jalil, Mumia Abdul-Jamal, Judy Clark, David Gilbert, Tom Manning, many political prisoners, people who could be doing an outstanding job out here. It is fascinating for me to mention some of those names and know, because I've had the opportunity to share space and time with them. And I know how good they are, and I know how interested they are in their own communities and with the struggle that they wage. So I think that if each one of us takes a little bit of his or her time to help, just even if it's just a letter to write to them, that would mean a great deal, because that would let them know that they are not abandoned or that they are not they have not been forgotten. And I think that if we do that, we will definitely be helping them. But the most important goal is to try to incarcerate them. And I think that you and all of us who believe that they should be incarcerated can do a very, very humane thing. It will be the most, probably the most precious expression of humane solidarity. So I think that I would encourage you to do something about the political prisoners.
Having spent so many decades in prison, what can you share with us about the deep flaws built into the American system of incarceration, especially solitary confinement, which you personally experienced and which has been condemned internationally as a method of torture? Our prison system is deeply broken, and you might be, you know, one of the foremost experts on the state of our prison system, having spent so much time there and now being able to talk about it freely.
I think that Amnesty International did a big service when it declared the prison systems, such as ADX, Supermax in Florence, Colorado, and the many prisons that have been constructed, built just with the same model as Supermax in Colorado. When it calls that a crime, a legal crime, I think Amnesty International hit the nail on its head. I think that when we experience, when we go through that experience of not having access to those elements of nature that are so important to us. For example, when we're deprived of looking at trees, when we are deprived of looking at the sun and seeing the sun on a daily basis, or to have that feeling of sun touching the skin, the fresh air, when we are subjected to live in a monochromatic environment, when we spend 22 hours and 45 minutes in a cell, that really dehumanizes not only the prisoner, but also those who work in the prison. And when a person spends many years behind bars, there's something that happens, and it's something that I noticed in the zoo. When I would look at a gorilla on the captivity, the eyes begin to lose their natural color. They begin to turn gray. And I see inmates who have become dead with their eyes in such color. I think that it is really, really destroying the humanity of that individual. The system itself, when I arrived in Leavenworth in 1981, there were 25,000 federal prisoners. Today there are probably 250,000 federal prisoners. The system itself is horrible. Up to 1995, a prisoner could get some kind of college education because the universities could go in there and get paid, because there was the Pell Grant. In 1995, the Pell Grant was eliminated. And one of the things that those of us who looked and consider education as a very important part of life, and we were in prison, we saw the prisoners who were part of that education, who were participating, who were trying to improve their lives, the overwhelming majority of them stayed out of prison. And so there's no need to create a system that is very, very expensive, but it's like what Laura Whitehall called the prison industrial complex, because it has become such. In 1981, in Leavenworth, an inmate, a prisoner, could make, $300-$400 a month. Today, a prisoner working as many hours can only make about $120 a month. So that gives us an idea of what was there then and the possibilities of rehabilitation and what is there today, that there's no rehabilitation whatsoever. To illustrate and to make my point even further, about 6 months before I came out of prison, there were two young Native Americans in a unit, a special unit in Terre Haute. And one of them took his eye out, and the other one cut one of his testicles. And that tells us the conditions that those two prisoners were in. Because probably the estimate is that about 35% of the prisoners in the system in the United States have mental problems. And how can a mental patient or a mental person, a person who suffers, who's not functional, be sent to an environment that is going to further dehumanize and further to destroy without access to the needs, to the medical professionals that they need, to the people that they need, and very, very distant, very, very separated from their families, their communities, and their loved ones. So I'm pointing this out in order to present to you a picture that very seldom gets painted. So I'm hoping that you will look at prisons for what they are. They're only there to warehouse human beings.
When your sentence was commuted by President Obama, many people in the press said, why is Obama freeing a quote-unquote terrorist? And today the Trump administration has been further criminalizing protest and activism. Under Trump, the FBI has been directed to investigate quote-unquote black identity extremists, which of course has echoes in history of how the FBI has criminalized freedom fighters of color in particular. How do we fight the narrative that paints left-wing activists as terrorists and extremists, while at the same time, white supremacists, armed white supremacists have actually caused more damage as we speak? How do we fight that narrative? Because unfortunately, many in the mainstream of America buy that rhetoric. Even liberal, so-called liberal media will accept this narrative that because you were fighting for Puerto Rican independence and freedom, somehow you were seen as a terrorist. It doesn't matter that today Nelson Mandela and Dr. King are seen as freedom fighters. At that time, when they were contemporary, when they were alive, they were also seen as terrorists. We shouldn't have to wait decades later to see people like you vindicated.
I think that the system itself has the power to define and how human beings are defined. It's based on the power, that power that they have. If a person, for example, if we were to be supporting union workers, and we go and we're demonstrating, we're marching, we're protesting, every single individual in doing that, workers and people who support fighting for decent wages, for better jobs, for better conditions, automatically, they are criminalized. In the eye, they're doing something that they shouldn't be doing, and they're doing something that probably will affect the interests of a corporation or the interests of a political party of a particular system. So the only way that we can really be effective is to look at what we do. And as long as we know that we're serving just and noble causes, not to stop, not to allow the whole system of criminalization to take us down. Because somewhere down the line, the truth will come out. And if we want a better and more just world, we will have to fight for it. It's not going to be given to us. While people are denying that climate change exists, while people are denying that the planet is getting warmer and warmer, that the ice is melting, we know that is happening. So we should be upfront and say we want that to change. If we see racism and do nothing about it, then racism will be perpetuated. If we see an injustice and we turn our back on that injustice, then we are aiding and abetting with those who committed the injustice. I think that the most important thing in order to change is a commitment, a self-commitment to create a better and more just world. And if we do that, if we look at the other as being part of the eye, I think that we will be moving into the right path. As long as we see ourselves as individuals and that we don't care but going to work, coming home, if we have a job, or you know, buying, going shopping and going, the whole thing of false entertainment, immediate gratification, those things, if that's how we fulfill our life, then the injustices and whatever happens to the environment, whatever happens to people who are fighting for justice and for freedom and justice, if we don't go the way that we shouldn't go, we are also contributing to perpetuate the system as it is. We're defending in a way something that people like Donald Trump or the Koch brothers or the Rockefellers or whoever it is that is in power, who has the power to make the decisions in this country, we align ourselves with them. One thing that I think would probably make the point clearer is that Donald Trump has committed a lot of crimes in this country, but nobody has the system itself has never criminalized him. And I was in New York City in 1969 when the lawsuit against Donald Trump and his father was filed. And the way they were not criminalized was because they went and negotiated with those who brought the lawsuit against them. there's no record. They did not commit a crime. But they were committing a crime because they were denying people access to housing. So that is the way that they can get away. That's the way that Donald Trump had a phony university. And he decided finally to pay $25 million, negotiated. But imagine having a false, we are in a university. Imagine having students pay for a school that was a farce. And that is a reality. So just the example of this person, one individual, how he addressed women, the way he treated women, the way he called women, the way he identified women, should be an indignity to all of us. It should be an indignity to the nation, but the nation itself, those who have the power, had already created an environment that would guarantee Donald Trump, a victory. People did not look at that. Those of us who follow politics a little bit, we knew that something was wrong because there were enough states to make sure that the Electoral College would be electing a very conservative, a very man like Donald Trump to the presidency of the United States. And by the way, 2020, the elections of 2020, those same states are still there. And they have right to work laws. It doesn't mean that a person has the right to work, but it's a way of beheading the whole system of union, of syndicalism. It is the way of making sure that the worker is less and less in a position to defend himself or herself. And that's all over the world. The pattern starts here, but that's all over the world. We live in a globalized world that was pushed around 1971. And I want to make a point here, because in 1971, this group of super, super rich people got together, and they said one thing. They said that the problem in the United States at that particular moment was that there was an excess of democracy. And they said we need to globalize and we need to privatize and we need to deregulate the banking industry. And every single thing that they proposed, even they said that citizens should not be pledging allegiance to the nation, but to the corporation. This is the only nation in the world that has made the corporation a citizen, the only one. So I think that once we wake up and say, hey, you know, something is wrong here, I think that we can see where we're going, what future awaits future generations.
So if you're rich, you get to subvert the criminalization of your actions. Before the hurricane hit, Puerto Rico was an example of disaster capitalism because the state of the economy was so devastated. And there has been this independence struggle that has been going on for decades. Has the hurricane, has the economic devastation strengthened or weakened the independence movement? Because people are leaving the island in droves because it's just hard to live there right now, which I know has made a lot of people, residents of the island, very, despairing to see their fellow family members and neighbors and relatives go to Florida or elsewhere to just be able to sustain themselves.
Well, the economy is the one that is defining our conditions primarily. The independence movement, I think that at this particular moment is beginning to do something that is positive. We were a very fractionalized movement, and I think that now more and more there's the message of unity. We're trying to not only bring unity in Puerto Rico to transcend ideological differences, but also we're trying to bring unity to the Puerto Rican diaspora. And the way I see the independence movement right now is that it's moving in a very positive way if we continue pushing the idea that there should be harmony among all of us, and that we can come together. The idea, you know, the idea would be to create like a big tent where every Puerto Rican who loves Puerto Rico, can come in and say, we want Puerto Rico to be decolonized. And I think that this is the moment. I dare say that within the next 2 years, we have this opportunity to come together, to do it in a very harmonious way. And if we do that, then we will be moving in the right direction. I see the potential there. We were celebrating organizing town hall meetings, something like town hall meetings, we call them conversatorios. And we have, in those conversatorios, we have the opportunity to talk about the problems that we see. We talk about the possibilities of solution to the problems, but also commit ourselves to work to find solutions to the problem. Because one thing is to talk about something, and the other one is to put elbow grease behind it. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to combine those things in our this dialogue that we are promoting throughout the 78 municipalities. And the reception has been very, very good. The other thing is, I've concentrated a lot of my energies in working in the most marginalized communities. And the most marginalized communities are very, very anti-independentismo. They do not support independence because they depend on food stamps. They depend on the things that are available to the poorest of the poor. And for them, they see a threat when we talk about independence. But then Maria has done something that is positive, and that is that it has been those marginalized communities where people have had to clean up, have had to fix their homes, and suffer a great deal without water, without electricity, finding ways to survive, and at the same time doing the things that before they were not doing. So I think that there was like all of a sudden they discovered that the neighbor was not his or her enemy, that the neighbor was also there cleaning. So if everyone worked together, that they were doing something positive. And we have been maintaining. And there's something that I want to point out. The three communities in the area where I've concentrated my energies, and those three communities, all three of them had a big, big problem with drugs, and they were fighting each other for the control of the drugs. And since September, there has not been a single shooting, there has not been a single fight, there has not been any conflicts, because we have been able to maintain that conversation and keep them thinking and working on something that is positive, and that is to make their communities better.
So it sounds like economic self-sufficiency is a critical step towards independence and towards the dignity and well-being of Puerto Rican people. And the Jones Act, as you mentioned, costs the economy billions of dollars a year, and the island has to import so many goods every year. Are there moves in the wake of Hurricane Maria to take the example of Cuba, for example, that has faced a decades-long embargo, and create sustainable economic models that residents of the island, that Puerto Ricans, can take hold of their own economy? You mentioned the solar potential for solar industries. Are there also alternative economic models on the ground, such as co-ops, that you're seeing in the wake of the hurricane?
Well, in the conversations that we have had, you know, the whole issue of cooperativas, cooperatives, we see the potential that is there, and there are people who work in a part of the cooperative system. That's one thing that we're working with. The other thing that we're working with, young people in Puerto Rico are beginning to do ecological agriculture and small farms, you know, but they are even after Maria devastated everything, because everything that was on the ground went to waste. But now, you know, they're renovating and they're really, really working hard to make it functional again. One of the things that we talk about and that we need to do is the whole thing of urban gardening. And I think that if we develop, if we little by little develop the agricultural, the small projects, we don't need anything big, we can do a big, big positive. We can take a very positive step towards being self-sufficient. I think that we have been creating small models, and those models will be emulated, will be imitated, will be replicated. And I think that that's what we are working on primarily, trying to show those who have doubts that we can do for ourselves what needs to be done. We can take the whole thing of urban gardening, and we can go to every community, because mostly all the communities have flat roofs. We have little pieces of land around the houses, so we can use it. And there will be of big help. I've done my share of gardening, so I know how effective and how much you can save by having those small gardens. So I'm one of those avid promoters of urban gardening, and you know, people definitely respond to it when they see it.
What are ways that Americans on the mainland can express solidarity most effectively with these sorts of efforts you were describing, with Puerto Ricans in general? Because given the current administration, there's certainly very little we can rely on by way of constructive U.S. government help. And I know that you've made it very clear that Puerto Rico doesn't need the United States help. So what about ordinary Americans, people-to-people solidarity? I know there's a lot of organizations on the ground here, but not everyone's aware of them. So ways for people in the mainland to support Puerto Rican efforts for self-determination.
I think that there are many, many ways that can happen. One of the things, there are organizations in Puerto Rico that are doing work. They can be identified, and people can help either by sharing their knowledge. For example, if we have an electrical engineer who knows how to deal with solar energy, or anyone who knows how to do better agriculture, things that are definitely viable and doable, and Puerto Ricans are trying to do that, they can be of great help. There will be, we will definitely have a lot of information posted in the networks, so people can definitely go there. We had a meeting in Humacao, one of the municipalities in the southeastern part of Puerto Rico, where there were quite a few North Americans there from different agencies. As a matter of fact, Naomi Klein was there. So it is a way of doing things concretely. You know, they were putting solar panels in that particular spot in a mess hall that they've created, a public mess hall that they've created. So those are the things that we can do. We can also, you know, things that can be funded. People can fund those legitimate organizations that are doing things, because money is needed in this world. You know, we can condemn capitalism, but wealth is wealth, and every nation needs its own internal market. So I think that it's important if people are give economic aid to those projects that are definitely doing things, and they're beautiful projects in Puerto Rico. There's one project in Adjuntas that is totally renewable energy, operates, even its radio station now is operated with alternative energy. Solar power is there, and they're using it.
I want to ask you the last couple of questions, if you don't mind, personal questions. You talked about the deprivation that prisoners face while they're in prison, the deprivation of color, and I immediately noticed your shoes, which are
beautiful, bright, and colorful. And you are an artist. This is something we haven't talked about either, and I've seen some of your art online, and it's beautiful, it's stunning. How did you use art and creativity to keep your sanity while in prison? And I feel like it's something that, you know, everybody finding that creativity to keep oneself going, to sustain oneself through dark times is a critical thing.
Let me share the use of colors. I had never painted before. In 1990, I realized that I was going to be held in solitary confinement for a long period of time. I had been in that particular penitentiary for 4 years, and they threw me in the hole. And after that, I had to start all over again. So there was this inmate, and he had told me several times, because he would see me drawing, why didn't I paint? Now, I knew that I was going to be subjected to a monochromatic cell for a long time, so I decided to start using colors. And little by little, I fell in love with painting, because it was helping me a great deal, but also it was my way to make a contribution to the outside world. There were probably five of us, of the Puerto Rican political prisoners, who were doing different artworks, and we would send it out to help with the campaign for our, because the campaign cost money, so it was a way of helping. And at the same time, was an exciting experience. I was able to teach art after I learned to do art to quite a few prisoners. And also, you know, because I'm bilingual, I also use my knowledge of both languages with prisoners who wanted to learn Spanish or wanted to learn English. And I always, whatever prisoner needed a hand, I always gave the prisoner a hand. But the whole thing of the art is very interesting, because I had no idea that I was going to fall in love with color. And I did. And so, but now I don't have the time to do much painting, and it feels terrible. It's just the same thing with the writing. I don't have the time to do as much writing as I would like to do.
Well, you're busy giving speaking tours, and then so my next question is, you spent decades in prison. You're on a speaking tour less than a year after you were walking as a free man. Many others in your position might have chosen to rest and relax for the rest of your life, saying you've done your time as an activist and, of course, done your time in prison. Why have you chosen to remain active? Why are you doing this? This takes a lot of energy, and we're grateful that you are, but what is it inside you that makes you remain active?
I think that my upbringing has a lot to do with my commitment to changes. I lived poverty. I felt it way deep in my bones. And I had a wonderful mother who always, from very early in life, inculcated in our heads that we had to be of service to the other. And we were poor, but whenever we would do something, we would share it with our neighbors. So I was taught to do that. I had a grandfather who had a profound love for the land, never used chemical fertilizers, processed fertilizers. And he had a profound sense of justice, loved the land, loved the animals, loved his neighbor. And he inculcated in my head that love for justice, that love for the land, that love for the environment, and to be protective of the environment. So I was blessed with that upbringing. And I've been told, hey, why don't you start resting now? And my family, especially my family, they get angry. Hey, why are you doing this? But it's almost like genetic, you know. I believe that as long as there are problems that I can probably help to resolve, I'm going to do it. And as Puerto Rican, as a citizen of Puerto Rico, I know that it behooves me to really, really do everything I can to give continuity to a struggle that is centuries old, because the struggle for independence of Puerto Rico starts with Spain, and the sacrifices that those who led the struggle, who saw, planted the seed of the importance of being a decolonized people, they inspire me. The prisoners who were imprisoned for defending Puerto Rico and the struggle for independence inspire me. There's a woman, there were five Puerto Rican prisoners when I came home in 1967. And I was allowed to hear some of the tapes of the five and other nationalists. And this woman, I'm listening to the tapes, and all of a sudden the voice of a woman comes into the taping system, and it is a very strong, very, very strong voice. And she said, I came to Washington not to kill anyone, but to give my life for Puerto Rico. And for me, that was a big challenge and an inspiration. She was an inspiration to me from that moment until the day that she died. And she still is in my thoughts and in my heart. So listening to her, her name was Lolita Lebron. She did 25 years in prison. She was released by President Carter with the others on the 10th of September, 1979. And it was a glorious day when she came out, and it was a painful day when she passed away, but she did a great, great contribution, especially as a Puerto Rican woman, showing the Puerto Rican people that the Puerto Rican woman, could lead, because she was the leader of the group that went into the Congress, and also to maintain that strong voice and the spirit, and to encourage us not to use violence. Mm-hmm. So there's a very strong woman, and that's, you know, for me is crucial. I shared this experience because it was an awakening, mm-hmm. and it was her voice and her strength. And those people inspire me that have made it clear to me that there's no option but to continue working and continue struggling.
Maybe one last question. We are at a moment in the United States where mass action is desperately needed given what we face. And as someone who has spent years involved in a struggle that has, you know, it's not easy to see the end in sight, that you sort of know that you might struggle your whole life and may not live to see the cause be met. What words of wisdom can you share with young Americans about finding their voice? They may not, you know, they may be, someday maybe they'll get that spark like you did with the voice of Lolita Lebron. Maybe they're sitting here in this audience today and getting the spark watching you and listening to you. But any words of wisdom for young Americans who are already struggling, maybe struggling to pay off their education, struggling to help their families be, you know, financially sustainable, but to still see activism, organizing, and that kind of civic work as critical to their life?
I think that for the young people, it is important to see themselves as the ones who would do and control and be in power for the future of the society. Every society, the future of it is in the hands of the young people. Young people have, they're creative, they have more energy, they have more time, and usually they're still in that stage of exploration, and they see, and they can see something, whether it's in the environment, whether it's walking and seeing people on the sidewalk. The thing that creates us to, makes us look and say, that's wrong. If we, as especially young people, if the young people see, even if it's just people throwing trash and make it, doing damage to the environment and saying, hey, let's not do that, you know. But the thing is that it has to be not as individual, but also looking at who is around them and looking at the possibilities that there are to change things, because everything is changing. The only thing that is impossible in this world is that doesn't get done. And every problem created by man has a solution. So if there are problems, even in the university with the cost of having an education, even that you're concerned. Whatever is happening within the university, it should be of concern and importance. So we all have to look at something and say, I don't think that that's right. And talk to the other person and see if that other person feels the same way. And if all of a sudden 100 voices come together, you know, and they say, okay, let's do something about it. That's a lot of power right there. And the power is with all of us. We have energies. We can discover energies that we did not know we had. For example, I'll give you a personal example. I was awakened when I was taken to the Supermax prison in Florence, Colorado. I was kept being awakened every half hour. And it's terrible. It's terrible. You know, 2 days, 3 days after, your body begins to change. Your body begins to change, your temperature changes, you go cold, you go hot, and so it a solution needs to be found. And at that particular moment, I was alone in a cell, and I was trying to figure out, but I had done deep breathing exercises, and I knew how to do them. And under those conditions, I started to go deeper and deeper, and then I would relax. And it was almost equal to having fallen asleep. And for 58 days, they kept that going. But on the outside world, there was a big campaign demanding that the penitentiary would stop doing such practices, such torture. And on the 58th day, the warden came and said, hey, Lopez, we're going to stop the half-hour watch, and we're going to go back to a normal watch. And he said, I'm giving you my word, but I need for you to tell the people on the outside world to stop the campaign. And I told him, if that's your word, I'll give you my word, and I'll tell people on the outside world to stop the campaign. I wrote a letter to a little newspaper called the Nuclear Resistor that same day. And 9 days later, I got the Nuclear Resistor with a photocopy of the letter on its front page. One of the staff from the warden came to see me, and step into the cell, and he said, hey, Lopez, you lied to the warden. And he had his hands behind his back. And I said, hey, don't call me a liar. Just get the information. Get things right. So he turns around and shows me a bunch of cards that people had been sending to the prison. And all of a sudden, you know, I show him the newspaper. I said, listen, read this before you call me a liar. He read it. He said, can I take this and show it to the warden? I said, you can do better. Tell the warden it's a gift from me, but I'm a man of my word. But the thing was that for 58 days, I was able to survive the torture. There were other prisoners. 2 or 3 days later, they had to be taken to the hospital because the palpitation was so high, and they couldn't function. So within us, we are endowed with powers that if we discover them, we have to work on them, and we find solutions. And those solutions can also be to help to make this a better and more just world. We can do it, everybody, but young people are the ones who have the future of every society in their hands. My worry in Puerto Rico is that the youth in Puerto Rico will be inheriting a $74 billion of OJ's debt that they will have to pay, because they will be paying for it if the Fiscal Control Board will have it its way. But I mentioned that just to show you that things can be done, okay?
Well, Oscar Lopez Rivera, on behalf of everyone, I want to thank you for sharing your presence with us today, your wisdom, your words. It's been an honor to share the stage with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I thank all these beautiful people who are here. And with a heart full of gratitude, I thank you, okay? So have a good day and enjoy yourself. Life is to be celebrated. Don't forget that. Can I point something out just as a response? Well, we talk about bombings and things that are of that nature. Probably people obviate facts. And in the South, for example, how many bombings took place of black churches, African American churches? In the South, how many people were denied the right to vote just because of the color of their skin? In the South and in the North, there were organizations that lynched people, and they got away with the lynching. People talk about something that happened in the 70s and the 80s or the 60s. But they still deny the fact that such thing as racism exists in this country, and that the racists can get away with things that others cannot. So I would like to bring that into this conversation too, because those of us who have been victims of racism know exactly what racism is. And I, as a Puerto Rican, have been called a spick, a nigger. I've been called those things. I have been denied entrance to places. I had to work hard to enter a university. It was not a gift to me. So, and I was drafted into the United States Army, okay? So there are things that I would like to bring out. As a matter of fact, I was taught by the United States military to kill, and I had license to kill. So that I want to bring this into this conversation, because it's important to have at least, every person has the right to speak, every person has the right to express, whether they're right or wrong, it doesn't matter. But it is good to bring facts out as they are, not as we wish. Wishful thinking is not going to resolve the problems of the world. I think that probably the most important thing for every person to do is to try to make this a better and more just world. We were trying. And I think that there are wonderful examples given to us. There was a Henry David Thoreau that inspired Gandhi. There was a Martin Luther King who was inspired by Gandhi. I think that we have examples of people who have given their lives struggling, giving us an idea of what a better and more just world would look like. And I think that if we want to have harmony and a better and more just world, we can do a lot of things. One problem that I would attempt not to repeat is sectarianism, because one of the problems within the left was that we allow sectarianism to come into, and we, rather than working together, sometimes we will spend time, messing around with each other. So I think that for the left, it's important to look for ways that we can harmonize the interests that we have in common, those things that we have in common. I also believe that differences are to be celebrated. You know, so it is not that we human beings, all human beings are fallible, are imperfect. So we have to deal with those things and try to transcend our own imperfections and our own fallibility. There's one story that I would like to share with you. When I arrived in Terre Haute, I was supposed to receive a religious visit, and the chaplain told me, I will not approve the visit because the person who's visiting you does not belong to the same religion that you belong. And I told him that I had been visited by members of different denominations, that practically every big denomination, people from different denominations, even theologians, had visited me in prison. And I told him that. Three months later, he allowed me to have the visit. But he asked me to talk to him, to have a little conversation with him. And we engaged in the issue of the death penalty. And I told him I was totally against the death penalty. And he told me, well, I believe in the death penalty. In Terre Haute, a year later, they started bringing the prisoners who had been condemned to death, because Terre Haute is the only institution with a space that is occupied by prisoners who have been sentenced to death. And in that group of prisoners, Timothy McVeigh, John Garza, and another individual, and they were already ready to be assassinated. And one day, he was the one who had to go and provide religious services to them. And one day he stopped me and he said, Oscar, I would like to talk with you. And we went and we sat and he said, I have come to know those guys and exactly what you told me, I have discovered their humanity. And I am totally against the death penalty. So just a conversation between a staff person and me, just a conversation brought this man into looking at the death penalty as something that should not be taking place, especially since for Christianity, it says, thou shalt not kill. And a person, whoever it is taking the life of another person who has been sentenced to death. So I mention this because it is important. I had no problems with the staff, Even real, real racist staff, because I believe I would try to look at their humanity, at the side of that they were human beings, dehumanized, but yet they were human beings with the potential to transform themselves to be better and more humane in their way of life.
Oscar Lopez Rivera is the acclaimed former political prisoner and Puerto Rican independence activist speaking with me at the Pasadena City College on February 7th, 2018. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.